Hello and welcome to the University of California Press podcast. I'm your host, Chris Gondek, and today I'm speaking with Laura Pulido, the co-author, along with Laura Baraclaw and Wendy Chang, of A People's Guide to Los Angeles. Laura Pulido is professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at the University of Southern California. Among her books is Black, Brown, Yellow, and Left, Radical Activism in Los Angeles, which is also published by the UC Press. Laura Pulido, thanks so much for taking time to talk to the University of California Press podcast today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here talking with you.
You know, Los Angeles isn't a city really known for maintaining its historical buildings and spaces. Now that you and your co-authors have finished this book, do you think that reputation is warranted?
I do think it's warranted. Yes and no. There certainly is a long history of places being dozed in Los Angeles on a regular kind of basis. If you think about the whole kind of development of Southern California, Los Angeles in particular, it's all predicated on land speculation, land development. So you see from the very beginnings this desire to, like, you know, to raise it, build anew, and for investment purposes. So that's a really important part of the story, and I think that kind of culture has stayed with us in Los Angeles. And, of course, it's also a place that's attracted so many recent immigrants. I mean, when I say recent, I'm talking about, you know, starting World War II. So, again, these are people coming to Los Angeles who don't necessarily have an investment in its history. And so I think that's one of the reasons why we have been very kind of callous and turned our back towards the dozing that's gone on and the lack of commitment to our historic preservation. Now, having said that, though, I think there's a whole lot of initiatives that are happening, particularly at the grassroots level, to preserve our local history. Not just history, but buildings, memories, events. We're trying to kind of memorialize these events in the landscape of Los Angeles. I know just last week I read that the city council, they had designated or somehow kind of commemorated where there was the first meeting of the Mattachine Society, which was a very important gay, lesbian organization in the 1950s, I believe. They had their first meeting there in 1950, and now they have the Cove Avenue steps have been memorialized as the Mattachine steps to commemorate that history, and particularly that of Harry Hayes. So I think that's really an example of the kind of stuff that's happening here in Los Angeles, all over the place. It's happening.
You know, it must be interesting to write a book about Los Angeles, looking at it from a social history point of view, for a bunch of different reasons. It's such a large city. There have been so many different cultures and so many movements. But I would think one of the special things that you have in Los Angeles is that so many areas of Los Angeles already have pretty sharp delineations in people's, I guess, cultural ideas, simply because Hollywood's there. If you think, when somebody says, what do you think about South L.A.? It's like, oh, that's South Central. That's where gangbangers are. What do you think about East L.A.? Oh, that's where the Hispanics live. What do you think about West L.A.? That's Hollywood. Did you run into this as you and your co-authors are developing this book, that as you're going through this, you're going, wow, people constantly have, mainly because of the Hollywood complex, certain views of different parts of Los Angeles that we're trying to basically expand?
Absolutely, we did. And in some ways, well, it is very true about Los Angeles, I should say. First of all, it is the most represented city in the world because of Hollywood being here, right? And, you know, I encounter this all the time in terms of my teaching, for example, with my students. They come in with these particular ideas, if they're not from the area, about what Los Angeles is or what part of Los Angeles, what it's like. So we kind of, like, start there a lot of times, and then we go out. All right, so, all right, you have these ideas about what constitutes, for example, South Central. Now we're going to try to blow that idea out of the water, right? And then we also try to use them, for example, as a starting place to talk about the power, about how places are produced, both the material processes, like the economic forces, such as Hollywood, that produce a place, but also the ideological work that it does, right? Because those are the things that really produce places, right? Both economic as well as ideological kinds of forces. So we definitely try to start with that and move from there.
Your book starts with a discussion of the Chicano moratorium and looking for where that started. What was the Chicano moratorium, and how hard was it to find the physical place where that took place?
The Chicano moratorium, it commemorates a major protest that happened on August 30th, 1970, and it was the largest anti-war movement on the part of any community of color up to that time in the United States. Chicanos were dying at a very disproportionate, both being drafted and dying at a rate disproportionate to our larger proportion of the population. And so there was a major protest. And what happened in this protest is that people gathered, they walked to a park which has now been renamed the Ruben Salazar Park, and they had a series of speeches and rallies there, and then the police came and they attacked the crowd, and this was a kind of one of those pivotal events in Los Angeles Chicano history, really the whole history of the Chicano movement, because for a lot of people what it did is that they understood very clearly, aha, kind of the police are the enemy, we're going to be attacked for speaking out. People understood very clearly how the lines were drawn from the event of the Chicano moratorium. It was very easy to find out where this actually occurred because a lot of people lived this history, and for a previous book I had done, Black, Brown, Yellow, and Left in Los Angeles, I interviewed a lot of people that participated in these events, and they told me exactly, well, we started off here, we marched over to here, and this is where these things happened. And the other thing that's very important about the Chicano moratorium is this was the day of the death of the journalist Ruben Salazar. He was a very important up-and-coming journalist and who focused primarily on the Latino population here in Los Angeles. He reported for KMEX as well as Los Angeles Times. And he had become increasingly critical of the war, and he attended the Chicano moratorium, and afterwards he went to a bar called the Silver Bullet, and he had a drink, he was in there, and then he was shot by LA County Sheriff's, by an LA County Sheriff. And eventually the sheriff was never charged, and in fact, even now today, there's still the aftermath of his death, this murder that's happening in LA County Sheriff, and Sheriff Baca has gone back and forth about whether to release the paper. So you see it's still very much a lingering event here in terms of what happened, in terms of local history. But it was very easy to find out where all these things occurred. That's what we consider much more recent history, and luckily we have LA Times articles and other newspaper articles and memories of people to tell us where these happened. Other events were much more difficult to track down.
Give me an example.
One of the hardest events we had to track down was the Sleepy Lagoon murder, which is a very important event in terms of Los Angeles history, in terms of community police relations, as well as in Chicano history. And what happened in the Sleepy Lagoon murder is a man named Jose Diaz, a young man, he was found murdered out near what is today kind of the industrial parts of I believe, Vernon and Commerce, kind of where they really meet in industrial Los Angeles. And this really led to a witch hunt of local Mexican-American youth. I think about 200 youth were initially pulled into the jails by law enforcement. And ultimately, I think 18 of them stood trial. And they were convicted, and they were sentenced to San Quentin in time. And in response, and this led to the development of the Sleepy Lagoon Defense Committee. And people really understood very early on it was kind of like a kangaroo court, and that the whole hearing and trial was kind of really it was a witch hunt, really. I mean, so many, if you look at the transcript of it, there were just so many kinds of questionable practices, infractions on the part of the judge. And ultimately, as I said, these youth were incarcerated, but then there was an appeal, a very important appeal, and ultimately they were all acquitted because of insufficient evidence. But this is an important event because at the time it really is a microcosm of the hysterical racist attitudes towards the Mexican-American population at this particular moment in time. Both the Zoot Suit Riots and Sleepy Lagoon murder, they occur in very close proximity to each other in terms of time frame. And they're kind of just like a little microcosm of what was happening in terms of racial attitudes towards Mexican-Americans at this point in time. But it was very hard to find where that Sleepy Lagoon murder took place. We looked through the court records, and interestingly, there was a map in the court record, right, that you could tell if you look at the transcript, because the witnesses and the judges saying, okay, I'm referring to Exhibit A here and stuff like this, those are not in any of the court records. From the courthouse, the archival stuff over at UCLA, it's not there. So we don't know what happened, and I'm very dependent on other people whose work also I conferred with on this. And nobody knows what happened to that to that map. So we're really, really close to where we think it occurred, but I don't say definitively. And so in the People's Guide, I list the address for Jose Diaz's house, which we know is, you know, within 100 yards probably of where he died, but we cannot say for sure where it was at.
You know, we talked a little bit about the whole, like, it's cultural sense that, you know, this is South Central L.A., this is East L.A., this is West L.A. Another kind of, I want to think, thing in people's minds about Los Angeles is the sense that because of the way the city developed, that yes, there is a downtown Los Angeles, but there really isn't a downtown Los Angeles like you would think of a downtown as an economic center in other cities, that there are different downtowns. You know, the old joke that Los Angeles is a city with a bunch of downtowns. Do you think that's accurate? Or does downtown Los Angeles, the traditional, you want to say, island, does it still, I guess, have a proportionate degree, overproportionate degree of power in how Los Angeles County's developed?
To my way of thinking now, downtown Los Angeles, certainly in terms of jobs, does not necessarily have, you know, a disproportionate number. I would say that make it an economic powerhouse just in terms of employment. But in terms of power, absolutely. I mean, there's still a lot of power in downtown Los Angeles. And we can think about that in a couple of ways. One, of course, is simply in terms of governance by the part of the local state, as well as, you know, the state of California and even the federal government. There's a tremendous concentration of government resources, services, administrative offices in downtown. So from that point of view, it's incredibly important. Then also, when you think about it in terms of corporate power, all right, there's still tremendous concentration in downtown Los Angeles of where decisions are made that will affect Los Angeles as well as the larger region and perhaps, you know, the Western United States really as a whole. So that's really, really important. And now many corporate headquarters have left Southern California over the last decade or so. So we really are at a low point, I think, in terms of corporate headquarters compared to the way we used to be. But there's still a lot there. There's still a lot there that is happening. And then Central Los Angeles or downtown Los Angeles still is really, really important in terms of both a diversity of communities as well as a larger kind of NGO world, right? Non-government organizations, grassroots organizations, nonprofits, they still, I think, far and away are concentrated in downtown Los Angeles. And they exercise, again, a lot of control in what the larger kind of civil society of Los Angeles is going to look like. So from a strictly and limited economic point of view, it may not be the end-all of places downtown Los Angeles, but it still is incredibly important.
When you think about the crossroads of all the different communities that have lived in Los Angeles, and they're all talked about in your book, whether they're Asian, Latin American, African American, women's movements that have happened in Los Angeles, the one that really kind of caught my eye, just because I never really thought of it before, and the way you present it as really kind of off the map as far as gay rights, was the Black Cat Bar. My first question is, does the Black Cat Bar exist, and could you talk about why it's significant to the Los Angeles gay community?
Oh, this is a very painful question. The Black Cat Bar, as our book was in production, it was closed.
Oh, no.
Yeah, really, really painful. I mean, this is one of the perils of a guidebook, is that it's dated, you know, before it's even out, right? So this is something we've thought about, and we thought of developing a website that could kind of be, will serve a multiplicity of functions. One is, like, people could go to these sites and write their own reflections. They could contribute their own sites that they think ought to belong in a people's guide. But we could also use it to update the book for these exact kinds of reasons. So that was really, really sad to us. So what the Black Cat was, or what it signifies, is that it was the site of L.A.'s first queer protest in 1967. And this is significant. First of all, this is not a well-known part of L.A. history, but also predates Stonewall in New York, which is often seen as, you know, the key watershed event for the beginning of the gay rights movement. But this predated that. And what actually happened here, this was a bar, and on New Year's, around midnight, when it's very conventional at bars and clubs, that people start kissing, right? You kiss whoever you're with, whatever, New Year's kiss. The LAPD comes in and starts beating people up and arresting them. So really, it was a very an intense attack on the queer community. And again, this was not out of the ordinary at all. These things were happening all the time in Los Angeles. There were all kinds of ordinances against, you know, gay people being who they are, and certainly public displays of affection on the part of gays, lesbians, bisexual, transgendered individuals. So what happens is there's this tremendous, you know, people are beat up, they're hospitalized, they're thrown in jail, and then a few weeks later, people come together at the Black Cat to commemorate what happened, and that actually then signals the first public queer protest in Los Angeles. People fighting, again, for their rights, against police abuse, demanding, we have a right to be who we are, you know, we're not hurting anybody, you know, let us be.
All right. This is a guidebook, and we obviously from the name. And not only do you take people geographically through these places, but if somebody wants to make a little holiday out of it, you do have restaurant recommendations there as well. I'm going to put you on the spot here. Is there one meal that you had during this research that really sticks out in your mind?
One meal that I had. I'll tell you one of my favorite places. This is hard to say. there are so many places. And I first tell you that we didn't initially want to do the restaurants. We didn't initially envision this as a guidebook, but we thought more of a coffee table book, you know, having these sites and these beautiful photographs and text about it. But the press and some other supporters like Gilda Haas were really very insistent, no, make it restaurant, you got to make it a guidebook. And so I think that's one of the things that actually does make it a guidebook, that there are all these restaurants in there. So, yeah, we have the restaurants. One of my favorite places is a place called El Parian, and it's over in Pico Union area, and to me they have the world's greatest burritos, and particularly I like their carne asada burritos from El Parian. Highly, highly recommended, although not a great place for vegetarians and vegans. And we do distinguish that in the guidebook. We kind of give reference, and we try to include a lot of vegetarian options, but, you know, Mexican food is a lot harder to do with that.
Laura Pulido, the co-author, along with Laura Baraclaw and Wendy Cheng of A People's Guide to Los Angeles. Thanks so much for being on the University of California Press podcast today.
Thank you.
For more information about this and other titles, please visit our website at www.ucpress.edu. Don't forget, you can look for us on Facebook, www.facebook.com/UCPress, or you can follow us on Twitter, where we are at UC Press. Thanks for listening to this episode of the University of California Press podcast. Copyright 2012, the University of California Press. All rights reserved.